This is Audible.
Canongate Books Limited presents Waiting for the Last Bus, Reflections on Life and Death by Richard Holloway, read for you by the author. 1. The Dance of Death. The medieval parish church of St. Mary Magdalene in the town of Newark in Nottinghamshire, England, is a huge building, so you have to look carefully for one of its most interesting features. When it was built in the 15th century, England was a Catholic country obsessed with what happened to people after death. It was believed that where you went when you died depended on the kind of life you had lived on earth. For the perfect, for the saint who had lived a life of heroic virtue, there was the prospect of eternal life in heaven. For the wicked, there was the prospect of eternal damnation in hell. It was a dramatic choice between endless joy and unending torment. But the church has always been good at finding ways to soften its harshest teaching, and that's what happened here. In the 13th century, the church invented a halfway house between heaven and hell called purgatory, from the Latin for place of cleansing. Purgatory was a moral laundromat, where sinners who had soiled their souls on earth were slowly bleached of their stains and restored to purity. It was painful for them, but unlike the souls in hell, for whom there was never any hope of escape, the souls in purgatory had the prospect of release to cheer them on. And the assistance of the living was another source of encouragement. It was believed that the prayers of those still alive on earth could hasten the cleansing of those in purgatory. The best way to speed them on was to have masses said for them in special chapels called chantries, from the French for chanting. Chantry priests were recruited by wealthy families to pray their relatives through purgatory, much the way a lawyer for a guilty defendant might enter a plea of mitigation on their behalf in order to reduce their sentence. In 1505, the prosperous Nottinghamshire Markham family built a chantry chapel inside St. Mary Magdalene and hired a priest to say mass there. On the outside of the stone panels of the little chapel, they painted a favourite subject of medieval artists called the Dance of Death. One panel showed a dancing skeleton holding a carnation, a symbol of mortality. On the other panel, there was a richly dressed young man clutching a purse. The skeleton's message to the young man was clear. As I am today, you will be tomorrow, and the money in your purse won't help you. It was a memento mori, a prompt to observers, remember you must die, to make them think about and prepare for their end. It's a far cry from how we do things today. Now we spend a lot of time and effort not thinking about death. To face our own death is quite literally the last thing most of us will do, if we're conscious enough at the time to do it even then. Even if we wanted to, the chances are we won't have much control over how we leave the scene. Death and dying have been taken over by the medical profession, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest that it sees death not as a friend we might learn to welcome, but as an enemy to be resisted to the bitter end. And the end often is experienced as bitter, as a fight we lost, rather than as the coming down of the curtain on our moment on the stage, something we always knew was in the script. People in the Middle Ages didn't have that luxury, if luxury it is. For them, life-threatening illness was as unpredictable and unavoidable as the weather, and they never knew when the lightning might strike. And considering what came after, it made sense to be prepared for death. In contrast to health professionals today, who advise us to remember the do's and don'ts of healthy living in order to delay death as long as possible, the medieval church was an advocate of healthy dying. It produced a guide on how to do it, called Ars Moriendi, The Art of Dying, a handbook for making a good end. Repenting and confessing your sins was the most important advice they gave the dying, and the reason why is captured by Hamlet in Shakespeare's most famous play. The young prince finds his hated stepfather at prayer and decides to kill him. "Now I might do it, Pat," now he is praying, "and now I'll do it." And so he goes to heaven, and so am I revenged. That would be scanned. A villain kills my father, and for that I, his sole son, do this same villain send to heaven. Oh, this is hire and salary, not revenge. Up, sword, and know thou a more horrid hent, when he is drunk asleep, or in his rage, or in the incestuous pleasure of his bed, at gaming, swearing, or about some act that has no relish of salvation in it, then trip him, that his heels may kick at heaven, and that his soul may be as damned and black as hell, whereto it goes. The message was clear. If you die before you've had time to examine your conscience, own your guilt, and confess your sins, you'll go straight to hell. And since you never knew when the bell will summon you, the safest course is to be ready at all times with your bags packed and your soul scrubbed clean. The other big piece of advice in the art of dying was about money. There are no pockets in a shroud, so you can't take your money with you when you die. But disposing of it wisely while you are still alive will help you secure decent lodgings on the other side. And there was a saying of Jesus that confirmed the message. Use your worldly wealth to win friends for yourself, so that when money is a thing of the past, you may be received into an eternal home. Those were the important messages packed into that little cartoon on the wall of the Chantry Chapel in Newark's parish church. I had travelled to Newark on a golden September day to visit Kelham Hall, a few miles away on the banks of the River Trent, and I was wondering if it might be my last visit. I had been returning insistently over the years to prowl the grounds and remember my life there more than 60 years ago, then a young monk trying and failing to give his life away to God in a grand gesture of self-sacrifice. I knew this constant returning was an unhealthy obsession, but I couldn't shake it. The Victorian parson poet Charles Tennyson Turner had already warned me of the dangers of trying to recover lost time. In the dark twilight of an autumn morn, I stood within a little country town where from a long acquainted path went down. The low of oxen on the rainy wind, death and the past came up the well-known road and bathed my heart with tears but stirred my mind. But I was warned, regrets which are not thrust upon thee seek not. Thou art bold to trust thy woe-worn thoughts among these roaring trees. Is't no crime to rush by night into the arms of time? These long acquainted paths had witnessed great changes since I had lived there in the middle of the last century. Kelham Hall was no longer the home of a religious order that trained poor boys for the ministry of the Anglican Church. Now it was a stately hotel, and on the day of my visit it was hosting a large British Asian wedding. For the ceremony, the massive dome chapel that had dominated my boyhood and haunted my dreams had been converted into a shrine to the Hindu god Ganesh, and it was filled with hundreds of joyful and colourfully dressed wedding guests. Did they catch the vibration of the hundreds of black-robed young men who had once tried to sacrifice themselves to God in this haunted space, now dominated by the friendly presence of the elephant god? It certainly did not feel like it to me, but to my surprise, this did not deepen my woe-worn thoughts. It banished them. I was touched by the cheerful indifference of the wedding guests to the ghost that whispered in my ear. Suddenly, something lifted in me, and I knew I wouldn't have to come back here again. What had been, had been. Now it was no more. I remembered Binion's The Burning of the Leaves. Now is the time for stripping the spirit bare, time for the burning of days ended and done, idle solace of things that have gone before. Rootless hopes and fruitless desire are there. Let them go to the fire, with never a look behind. The world that was ours is a world that is ours no more. I decided to let the past go, and turn to what was left of my future. I left Kelham happier than when I arrived. But the day's surprises weren't over. The great tower of St. Mary Magdalene dominated the flat Nottinghamshire landscape. I'd been noticing it for most of my life, most recently from the train window on trips between Edinburgh and London. But I'd never entered it, never seen what it was like inside. If my compulsive visits to Kelham were over, this was my last chance. So on my way to the station in Newark, I went in to look around and found that skeleton doing his dance of death. It had an interesting effect on me when I saw it. It did not compel me to rush off to confession to purge my conscience of its sin, but it did remind me that I was speeding towards the final curtain. It made me think. I had been taught to treat skeletons with respect while I was a curate in 1960s Glasgow by my rector's son, a medical student who went on to become a distinguished physician in Africa. He had invited me to a student party and was disappointed when he discovered that one of his fellow medics had borrowed a skeleton from the anatomy lab and laid it in the bath to surprise visitors to the lavatory. I was amused by the prank till he reminded me that the skeleton had once been a pulsing, laughing human being. Someone had once known and loved this object of fun, now lying in a bath in a student flat on Byers Road. Skeletons remind us that devouring time will get us all in the end. It has been reckoned that since we appeared on the planet, there have been 107 billion human beings, 7 billion of whom are alive today. That means that the skeletons of 100 billion of us have faded into the earth. Occasionally we come across one that's been buried for thousands of years, and we wonder about the life it had, its joys, its sorrows, and what it made of the world it found itself in. I remember thinking about this when I first saw the famous photograph of human skulls at the Nyamata Genocide Memorial in Rwanda. In 1994, 1 million Tutsis were massacred by the forces of the Hutu-led government of Rwanda. Taken in 2007, the photograph shows a tray of some of the human skulls recovered from the killing fields, relics of one of the worst crimes of the 20th century. It's the empty yet staring eye sockets that haunt the viewer. Vivid lives cut short, and the knowledge that one way or another we'll all come to this. We'll end as skeletons or as the ash of skeletons. As I am today, you will be tomorrow. And the process starts well before we die. It wouldn't be so wrenching if we never aged and didn't see death coming for us with or without a machete in its hand. We'd run and laugh and climb mountains and dive into the sea with undiminished energy our whole life long. Then, at an unexpected moment when we were in the middle of our song, we'd be taken by death and the glory of our being, and it would be over in a second. That's not how our dance towards death usually goes. If we live long enough, we become witnesses to our own slow dying and the revelation of the skull beneath the skin. Psalm 90 says, "The days of our age are 80 years, and though men be so strong that they come to 80 years, yet is their strength then but labour and sorrow. So soon passeth it away, and we are gone." I have reached 80 years. And though my life is not yet but labour and sorrow, I am aware that the shutting down of my body has begun. I am well into the last swing of the dance, and I can feel the beat quickening. That's what has prompted these reflections on being old and facing death. I remember when I noticed that coloured patches like stains on old stone had started to appear in my face and body. When you get old, the garbage disposal mechanisms designed to clear out waste in your skin cells start to break down. Instead of cleaning the rubbish away, like lazy bin men, they leave it lying around in the street, your skin, and it clots into those yellow-brown patches called lipofuscin, better known as age spots. A few years ago at the Edinburgh International Book Festival, the press team photographed the writers with a special camera that subjected their skin to a ruthless high-definition exposure of every flaw and wrinkle. When my picture went up in Charlotte Square a few days later, it revealed a face blotched and stained with patches of lipofuscin even I hadn't noticed before. The bin men of my epidermis had obviously gone on permanent strike. That was when I realized that the wind down of my body was well advanced, and there would be more to come. Mind you, for me, the process had started in my 20s, when I started going bald. Baldness is not a terminal disease, of course, but it is a permanent condition, and I hated it when it started. I fought it in all the usual hopeless ways. I even bought pills advertised in a church magazine. The manufacturers probably thought the readers of Church Illustrated would have a stronger gift of faith than other baldies. The pitch worked on me. I sent off for the pills. Nowadays, the law would require an accurate description of the chemistry of the product that came through my letterbox a few days later, but none of that was required in 1958. They looked like little brown Smarties, and like Smarties, they were probably made of sugar. I started swallowing one a day. My hair continued to recede. Hopelessly, I flushed the remaining pills down the toilet and started combing what was left on top to the front, trying to look like Marlon Brando as Mark Antony in the movie Julius Caesar that was out at the time. It was a vain response to a disagreeable reality. It may delude the owner for a moment, but the comb-over is an embarrassment that takes no one in. Depressed, yet defiant, one day I cropped the whole thing off, and that's what I've done ever since. It was an early lesson in accepting things about myself I did not like but could not change. I see now that losing my hair was a good preparation for aging and death, the skeleton being the ultimate baldy. Maybe I've been lucky to have had an early rehearsal. My unsuccessful struggle with baldness taught me something about the human condition. Humans are afflicted with a tragic self-consciousness that does not seem to bother the other animals. All animals feel pain, but the one pain that seems to be unique to humans is an awareness of our bodies that is so keen it can lure us into depression and self-hatred. We're not only aware of our own bodies, we are aware of others' awareness of them. We're conscious of looking at others and being looked at by them, and we wonder what they make of what they see when they see us. How did this obsession with our appearance start? Was it there before mirrors and cameras were invented? Would we be bothered by what we looked like if we couldn't see ourselves as others see us? However it started, our self-image seems to have obsessed us for centuries. The first-century Roman poet Ovid adapted an old Greek myth to explore the subject. Narcissus, the son of a river god and a local nymph, was famous for his beauty. The blind seer Tiresias warned his mother that Narcissus would have a long and happy life only if he never saw himself. Unfortunately, he caught sight of his own reflection in the waters of a spring, fell in love with what he saw, and died of unrequited love. If an experience has been developed into a myth like that, it's because its theme is universal. It expresses a reality that troubles the human community. This one suggests that we'd be better blind than obsessed with how we look, because it's a compulsion that can never be fully satisfied or appeased. Freud took the story further and coined the term narcissism for anyone suffering from an overpowering degree of self-esteem, a condition he diagnosed as a form of emotional immaturity. It is captured in the caricature of the egotist, usually a dominant male, who pauses in his narrative of self-glorification only long enough to say to his listener, "But enough from me. Tell me how you rate my accomplishments." Narcissism, in both its classic and Freudian forms, has become a prevalent disease in late modern societies obsessed with image and the screen technologies that promote it. It supplies the energy for one of the main enterprises of modern capitalism, the anti-aging and postponement of death industry, what we might call the AAPD complex. We spend fortunes delaying death and the physical dissolution that precedes it, and it starts early with our revolt against the reality of the bodies we were born with. Had I been born 60 years later, would I have saved up for hair transplant surgery rather than wasting my money on those wee sweeties advertised in Church Illustrated? And would I have missed learning one of the best lessons life teaches, that it's better to accept reality rather than deny it, including the reality of our own bodies and the death that is their only end? Throughout most of history, humans had no alternative but to accept these certainties. In our advanced technological society, that's no longer the case. We spend fortunes trying to refashion our bodies and postpone our deaths. And it's easy to understand why. Anguish is a hard thing to bear, even if it's only the anguish of not liking the way we look. The anguish of dying is harder still, especially if it comes before we are ready for it, and we feel cheated of the time we thought we had left. But there's no escape from anguish. It comes with the human condition and the self-awareness that is its key component. The secret is to learn how to live with it. Accepting the reality of the way we look and the certainty of our death, maybe one day soon, won't make us happy, but it might save us from the greater unhappiness of trying to ignore or hide from these realities. The fleeting pain of admitting our situation is preferable to the constant pain of denying it. It takes fortitude, the most useful of the old virtues. Fortitude is one of the most important lessons life teaches, and aging may be our last chance to learn it. It's the ability to endure the reality of our condition without flinching. It was defined by the gay cowboy in the movie Brokeback Mountain, "If you can't fix it, you gotta stand it." And there's a lot you gotta stand when you get old, such as going deaf. It hasn't happened to me yet, but it has to my wife. What distresses me is that I find it irritating. Much of the time I have to shout to be heard by her, a small price to pay for close contact with someone I love, yet it constantly annoys me. That says something to me about larger society as well as my own impatience. If we're not careful, we can start resenting the presence of the elderly in our midst and the minor irritations they impose upon the rest of us. Their deafness may annoy me, but the glacial way they move can induce bouts of sidewalk rage in me. The day will come when I'll walk more slowly too, but I'm still fleet of foot, so I get angered by those who hold up my progress along the street or through the aisles of the supermarket. I mutter to myself that they shouldn't be allowed out after the age of 70 unless they can pass a minimum speed mobility test. For God's sake, why can't they get a move on? If I can have these terrible thoughts about the old in my 80s, I wonder how the millennial generation feels. Worse than losing your hearing or your mobility is losing your short-term memory. Those moments when you can't find a name or forget what you were just about to say to someone. My wife and I joke that we have one good memory between the two of us. That's the best way to handle the aging business, with a sense of humour. The blacker, the better. In his 90s, my father-in-law stopped buying green bananas because he didn't think he'd live to see them ripen. Apart from humour, another source of consolation in old age is that vanity and self-consciousness fade away. In his memoir, the American novelist John Updike mused on how embarrassed he used to be by the hats his father wore when he was old. Then, when he reached that time of life himself, he found himself wearing the same battered monstrosities. I too have a shelf full of embarrassing lids that I fancy give me a jaunty glamour. My wife tells me they just look daft. Well, daft it is. I shall embrace my inner scarecrow and agree with the Irish poet W.B. Yeats that an aged man is but a paltry thing, a tattered coat upon a stick, unless so claps its hands and sing, and louder sing. It is possible to say a rueful yes to our fading energies and begin to appreciate the humour and understanding that old age can bring. Much more difficult is giving up the prospect of the future, not so much my own as that of my children and grandchildren, not to be there to see them make their way through life, and not just to see them, to be beside them when they hit sorrow, as they will, for no one misses it, to be someone they talk about, no longer someone they talk to. That's what the English poet Philip Larkin most hated about death. He described it as the total emptiness forever, the sure extinction that we travel to and shall be lost in always, not to be here, not to be anywhere, and soon, nothing more terrible, nothing more true. Nothing more true, certainly, but why should it be so terrible? After all, we won't be there to know we're not there. When you're extinct, you don't realize it, so it can't hurt. The Greek philosopher Epicurus said that feeling the not being there that follows death is as silly as regretting that we weren't here before we were born. But it's not the thought of being dead that troubles us. It's the prospect of leaving and losing those we love that grabs us by the throat. And we already know something of what that feels like. Life has given us many anticipations of our dying. We only have to recall the memory of other separations to realize how wrenching the last one is going to be. The frail figure watching our car disappear round the bend before turning in at her lonely door. The moment in the station when we can't say goodbye because our heart is filling our throat, and we clutch hands and turn away. Someone is waving a white handkerchief from the train as it pulls out with a white plume from the station and rumbles its way to somewhere that does not matter. But it will pass the white sands and the broad sea that I have watched under the sun and moon in the stop of time in my childhood, as I am now there again and waiting for the white handkerchief. I shall not see her again, but the waters rise and fall and the horizon is firm. You who have not seen that line hold the brimming sea to the round earth cannot know this pain and sweetness of departure. Painful as those partings are, there may be the promise of future meetings to console us, and there are ways of keeping in touch with people we love that can compensate us for their distance. In dying, we face the final and absolute separation, not only from those we love, but from ourselves. Dying not only kills our bodies, it kills our future. I look at my grandchildren now in all their vivid promise, knowing I will miss seeing where their lives take them, and a quiet sorrow touches me. It doesn't overwhelm me, but as I gaze at them with pride and wondering affection, I hear a distant bell toll. and I know it tolls for me. In old age, this kind of rumination can make us feel sad about the future we're going to miss. But that shouldn't be the primary emotion we feel at the end of a long life. It should be gratitude. We won a rare lottery ticket when we were born. There must have been something in our DNA that beat the odds against fusing the sperm with the egg that made our particular existence possible. Millions did not make it off the wasteful assembly line in the great reproduction factory of life. We got through. We made it. For that, at least, we should be grateful. And even more grateful for the world that received us and nurtured us, for the fact that it was there to receive us. I have known people who have died in a mood of absolute gratitude for the life they'd had and the love that was given to them. They were sad at leaving the party earlier than they hoped, but grateful for the good time they'd had while they were there. Their last days became an act of thanksgiving for what they had received. There's an illuminating moment at the end of Alan Hollinghurst's novel, The Line of Beauty, which is set during the early days of the AIDS epidemic in Britain. Nick, the hero of the novel, has just had an HIV test. He knows the result will be positive and he'll die soon. Hollinghurst tells us, Nick dawdled on rather breathless, seeing visions in the middle of the day. He tried to rationalize the fear, but its pull was too strong and original. It was inside himself, but the world around him, the parked cars, the cruising taxi, the church spire among the trees, had also been changed. They had been revealed. The emotion was startling. It was a love of the world that was shockingly unconditional. He stared back at the house and then turned and drifted on. He looked in bewilderment at number 24, the final house, with its regalia of stucco swags and bows. It wasn't just this street corner, but the fact of a street corner at all that seemed, in the light of the moment, so beautiful. As death approaches, there will be sorrow for what it will take from us. But that is a mean and grudging way to greet it. If we let it, death will reveal the beauty of the world to us, the fact of a street corner at all. Maybe we've left it late. Maybe we wish we'd noticed it before, paid it more attention. Push that thought aside. Don't fret. Look at it now, so beautiful, and be grateful. And maybe you can arrange your deathbed looking out on a street corner you know. 2. Losing It. In his most famous poem, the Welsh poet Dylan Thomas advised his dying father not to give up without a fight. Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. It is the rage of the old that I want to think about now. And not just the kind Dylan Thomas was talking about. That was rage at dying, at being dragged away from the party before you were ready to leave. There can be something heroic about that kind of resistance, and it's why some people, almost without being aware of it, fight hard against their own death. I've sat by the beds of many who are dying and marveled at how long it was taking them to leave. Their relatives would be worn out sitting beside them day after day as they battled the inevitable. But the nurse in attendance always knew what was going on. He's a fighter, she would say. He won't let go to the last minute. And it won't be long now. Then the moment of surrender would come, a last sigh, and it was over. This defiant resistance of death seems to be stronger in some people than in others, part of their character. And the will to live can persist in them long after they've lapsed into a coma. I'm always moved when I see this happening. It suggests to me an event in the boyhood of the writer Leonard Woolf when he was told to drown 5 newborn puppies. When he plunged the first tiny blind creature into the bucket of water, it began to fight desperately for its life, struggling, beating the water with its paws. He suddenly realized that it was an individual, an I, and that it was fighting for its life just as he would were he drowning. Like those blind puppies, death's resistors struggle against the forces that are shutting them down. It's hard not to be moved by this. It is probably the energy that kept them going as long as they did. But they all have to give in at some point. Death gets everyone in the end. If it didn't, life would soon become unsustainable on our little planet, and there are worrying trends already pointing in that direction. One of them is the way the medical profession has wheeled formidable new artillery onto the battlefield and spends vast amounts of money and effort delaying death's victory. I don't apologize for the military metaphor, because it's the one favored by doctors themselves. With the best of intentions, they have taken control of the lives of old people today, and they fight hard to keep them in the field as long as possible. The result for many of them is a medicalized existence whose sole purpose is staying alive long after any joy in doing so has fled. Keeping most of us alive well into our 80s is one of the successes of modern medicine, but there are signs it's having a profoundly distorting effect on the balance of society as a whole. In Britain, the care of the elderly is close to swamping the resources of the National Health Service, turning it into an agency for the postponement of death rather than the enhancement of life. We don't have to go back to the 15th century to find a more balanced approach. Not that long ago, before they had this colossal armory at their disposal, most doctors were willing to acknowledge death's approach. They saw their role as helping death in with the minimum of distress to everyone. Nowadays, they're more likely to call in the medical engineers to dig a moat and fortify the door against death's entrance. But there are signs that the more thoughtful among them are beginning to challenge the siege mentality. The American physician Atul Gawande has recently suggested that while medicine exists to fight death and disease, it should learn how to fight for territory that can be won and how to surrender it when it can't. And doctors need to understand that the damage is greatest if they insist on battling on to the bitter end. Old age can be bitter if it is experienced not as a period of calm preparation for death, but as a grim battle to keep it at bay. It can even breed resentment in the old against the very doctors who are working hard to keep them going. Visiting the elderly can be a dispiriting experience if they spend the time rehearsing their ailments and complaining about the inattention of the local health professionals who run off their feet trying to care for them. The reality is that death has rung their bell, and peace will come only when they open the door and say, "You got here sooner than I expected, but come in and sit down while I get my coat on." If the refusal to accept the imperative of death is a relatively new phenomenon, an older affliction is the anger of the old at the young for being young. At its root, this is one of the many forms of the sin of envy. Envy has been defined as sorrow at another's good. Sometimes it's confused with jealousy, but there's a world of difference between them. The jealous want what other people have, and it may provoke them to work hard to achieve it, which is why keeping up with the Joneses is a proverb. Jealousy may drive us to action, but envy only makes us depressed. Rather than rejoicing in the happiness of others, their youth and vitality and beauty, it makes us sad. It can prompt bitterness towards the young for being young, revealed in the snort of contempt at how they colour their hair or tattoo their bodies or collide with you in the street because they're always in their bloody phones. It's an ugly picture, the face of angry, envious old age. We often see it on television, during interviews with the public on the issues of the day, and it can have a solid impact on government. Elderly voters are a powerfully reactionary force in politics, both in the United Kingdom and in the United States. They are more disciplined and consistent than the young in voting, so as they increase in size as a cohort of the population, their envies and resentments are bound to have an increasingly distorting effect on political processes. There is already a lot of evidence that they have had a profound effect on recent elections and referenda in both these countries. If these trends continue, in a few years a number of Western democracies will have transformed themselves into gerontocracies, governments of the old, by the old, for the old. Geriatric resentment is a dangerous disease to catch, so it's worth examining ourselves to see if it has infected us. The chances are that we've caught it, if only a mild version, because it is hard to avoid. Each generation has to learn how to take a bow and leave the stage, and we have to do it at the time in our lives when we are least resilient. Old age is a poignant business, a continuous series of losses, which is why Betty Davis said it wasn't for sissies. One of its saddest moments is when we realize we're no longer at home in the world and are baffled at how it operates. When we were young and the future was filled with promise, it was thrilling to celebrate the constant shift and change of history and embrace every fad that came off the assembly line, as well as being impatient with those who resisted the new and clung desperately to the old and the outworn. It's a different matter when you realize that almost without noticing it, you have joined the ranks not only of the old, but of the old-fashioned, and that the crazy shifts of change you embraced so eagerly when you were young are the very energies that are now carrying you into the past, along with steam trains and quiet Sundays. So it's hardly surprising that the old can begin to feel like strangers in their own land. But it's a mistake to think it's a modern disease. The bitter old person is a constant in history. It seems to be age that corrodes the spirit, not change as such, which is why growing old can be spiritually dangerous. Go back as far as you can, and you'll hear the old grumbling about the young. In the century before the birth of Christ, the Roman poet Horace heard an elderly man at it, tiresome, complaining, a praiser of the times that were when he was a boy, a castigator and censor of the young generation. The tone of these attacks on the younger generation is not always as angry as Horace's old man. Sometimes it's reproachful and weary, a wry shaking of the head at the excesses of the young. This is the spirit of Alec Guinness's memoir, A Positively Final Appearance. The famous film star even complains about the length of movies nowadays. What good stories were told in the cinema in those days, swiftly, directly, and without affectation. And how blessedly short they were when compared to the three-hour marathons that we are now expected to sit through with aching bums, fatigued eyes, and numbed ears. Behind these complaints and reproaches there is hurt and sadness at the way time sweeps each generation aside, famously expressed by Isaac Watts in his hymn, O God, our help in ages past. Time, like an ever-rolling stream, bears all its sons away. They fly forgotten as a dream dies at the opening day. That it is a Christian hymn that best describes the rush of remorseless time is no accident. Religion is one of the few institutions that keeps the thought and fact of death steadily before us. It's what intrigued the poet Philip Larkin about churches, that so many dead lay round them, he thought, made them proper to grow wise in. But you don't need a burial ground round a church to be reminded of death. There are reminders inside as well. Being a member of a congregation is to watch chairs emptying as death accomplishes its work. In John Meade Faulkner's poem Christmas Day, The Family Sitting, an old man in church meditates on Christmases past. There are passed one after the other Christmases 53, since I sat here with my mother and heard the great decree, how they went up to Jerusalem out of Galilee. They have passed one after the other. Father and mother died, brother and sister and brother taken and sanctified. I am left alone in the sitting with none to sit beside. The pillars are twisted with holly, and the font is wreathed with yew. Christ, forgive me for folly, youth's lapses, not a few, for the hardness of my middle life, for age's fretful view. Nowadays, sitting in church, I am often more aware of the presence of the dead than of the living. I remember where they sat, a hymn they loved, sung again this morning, and maybe the bitterness of their passing. But it's a fortifying, not a depressing experience, a reminder that this is how it goes and that I must be reconciled to it. One day my seat will be empty and my name will be written among the dead. Going to church is one of the ways I gather the past round me as I prepare to go up to Jerusalem out of Galilee. But it has become a more complicated business than it used to be. For many old people today, going to church can be an alienating rather than a consoling experience. To understand why will take a bit of thinking about religion itself. The best way to see religion is as humanity's response to the puzzle of its own existence. Unlike the other animals on earth, we have never felt entirely at home here. Our big brains prompt us not only to wonder about our own existence, but about the existence of existence itself. Is there a reality behind it that created it, and can we relate to it in any way? Some of us think compulsively about these questions and come up with a stream of never very certain answers. The instrument we use for wrestling with them is the human mind. Our difficulty is that we can't really be certain anything exists outside the mind, because the mind is the main agent we have for examining the question. The Cambridge theologian Don Cupert tells us there is a German word that captures the difficulty, Unhintergehbarkeit, un-get-behind-ability. Our knowledge of the universe comes to us through the mind, and we can't get out of it or off it to prove anything's behind it, or nothing's behind it, except through the mind itself. We're stuck in and with our minds. And even if we want to resist that claim, it is only our minds that can challenge it, thereby proving the point. Living with the un-get-behind-ability of the universe is frustrating, which is why we search for ways to resolve our predicament, either by convincing ourselves there is definitely nothing behind it, or there's definitely something and we've met it. Since it is impossible to prove the truth of a negative factual statement, there's no one there, absolute atheism only ever appeals to a passionate minority. But those who insist that there is someone there can't prove it either. What they offer is testimony or witness. Religion's most interesting characters are those who claim to have encountered the mystery behind the universe directly. They claim to have seen or heard it. It revealed itself to them. An example from within the Christian tradition is the French religious and mathematical genius Blaise Pascal. After his death, a paper was found stitched into the lining of his coat that recounted a mystical experience he'd had on the 23rd of November 1654. This is what was written on the scrap of paper. Fire! God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, not of the philosophers and scholars. Certainty, certainty, feeling, joy, peace. The fact that he told no one about the encounter was unusual, because religious witnesses usually want to share what they have seen or heard. Sometimes they attract followers, and another religion is born from their revelations. Pascal kept to himself what had happened, but it changed his life. It took him from thinking about God, not of the philosophers and scholars, to an encounter with God. For those like Pascal who claim to have been taken behind the veil of the universe, the experience is self-authenticating. Doubt is eradicated. Certainty, certainty. That's why they're so persuasive. There's nothing like absolute conviction to persuade others to go along with you. But for those who go along, unless they are mystics themselves, doubts about the meaning of the original encounter always remain. To use one of Pascal's own descriptions, their faith is a gamble. The followers of a revelation are called believers or people of faith, and doubt is part of the deal. That's why faith is often characterized as a struggle. The faithful are told to pray to have their faith strengthened, a form of words that gives the show away. We don't pray to have our grasp of facts strengthened. We don't pray to believe more firmly in the two times table. We know it's true. We can do it on our fingers. Faith is different. By definition, it is tinged with uncertainty. This is fine for individuals, but it doesn't work for religious organizations, especially if they're keen on marketing themselves to unbelievers. Doubt doesn't sell. Certainty does. The organizers who systematize a religion based on the experience of a prophet have a product to sell, and they know diffidence won't move the goods. That is why, as religions develop, they shift from exhortations to faith to proclamations of fact, including confident descriptions of the world or worlds behind the one that is available to our senses, the one our minds connect us to. That is how the big theistic religions started, and by the time they reach us hundreds of years later, their original claims are beyond any definitive investigation or interrogation. That is why they become the source of endless, irresolvable disagreements about their truth. Rival schools of interpretation battle each other over the meaning of the original revelation. And because of the un-get-behind-ability factor, there is no arbiter on earth who can resolve their disagreements, so they jostle and collide with each other like logs of timber on time's ever-roaring stream as it carries them through history. But while this is going on, something else is happening at the same time. To capture it, I'll have to shift from a fluvial to an arboreal metaphor. Religions gradually thrust themselves above their mystical origins into real history, where they stand like huge trees able to shelter many different forms of attachment and meaning in their branches. Though they still claim to be rooted in the eternal world, in this world, they represent values that are helpful to many who have little interest in the supernatural claims they make about their origins. For faith systems to let themselves be used in this way requires a tolerant generosity that appears to be under threat today. I am writing this a few days before Christmas. For weeks, the shops have been jingling with carols, and the streets have been decked with lights, and I enjoy it. Scotland is a cold, dark place in the middle of winter, so I can understand why the ancient pagans cheered themselves up with a winter festival that reminded them the days would lengthen soon, and spring would start its slow trail north. I can also understand why the Christian church decided the pagan festival was a great idea and called it Christmas, a theft that would be dismissed today as cultural appropriation, forgetting that we've always borrowed from each other to help us through life's dark nights. Christmas is the one time of the year when churches will be packed. Almost in spite of themselves, people are drawn to sing carols and hear the story of a baby laid in a manger because there was no room in the inn. This is how C.D. Lewis described it in a poem. It is Christmastide. Does the festival promise as fairly as ever to you? I feel the numbness of one whose drifted years conceal his original landmarks of good and ill. For a heart weighed down by its own and the world's folly, this season has little appeal. But tomorrow is Christmas Day. Can it really mean nothing to you? It is hard to see it as more than a time-worn tinsel routine, or else a night incredibly starred, angels, oxen, a babe, the recurrent dream of a Christmas card. You must try again. Say, Christmas Eve. Now, quick, what do you see? I see in the firelit room a child is awake, mute with expectancy for the buried day, the presents, the Christmas cake. Is he mine or me? He is you and yours, desiring for him tomorrow's feast, the crackers, the tree, the piled presents. You lose yourself in his yearning and borrow his eyes to behold your own young world again. Love's mystery is revealed when the father becomes the child. Yet would it not make those caroling angels weep to think how incarnate love means such trivial joys to us children of unbelief? No, it's a miracle great enough if through centuries clouded and dingy, this day can keep expectation alive. It is poetry that draws people into church at the end of December to gaze again at the recurrent dream of a Christmas card. The paradox is that it is the people who think religion is prose who keep it alive for the people who can only use it as poetry. When a religion is in decline, its prose becomes more defensive and assertive. But if it is not careful, it loses the capacity for what the poet John Keats called negative capability. That is, when man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. Its very existence now threatened, the church is in danger of becoming a club for strict believers who have little tolerance for religious versions of negative capability. And it can be devastating for elderly parishioners whose practice of faith always owed more to John Keats than to Billy Graham. One of the features of my latter years is to be invited to speak to groups of people who think of themselves as the church in exile. Most of those who turn up are about my own age or only slightly younger. They're all people who've stopped attending church because they find the new assertive tone impossible to bear. The growing congregations, the versions that attract the young, have learnt the old lesson that certainty sells and conviction satisfies. They have the vibrancy of student societies high on their own virtue, who have gathered together to fortify themselves against their enemies. It can be devastating for the mildly religious, for whom religion was once a source of spiritual comfort and moral challenge, to be told there is now no room in the inn for doubt and uncertainty. I know a woman who was told by her new minister that her late father, an old-fashioned Presbyterian of the post-war liberal variety, was now in hell, and he would remain there forever because he had not been born again into the version of Christianity that was now in the ascendant. So, added to the losses that accumulate in old age, can be sorrow at the loss of the church itself. And it's a double sorrow. There is the private sorrow of being exiled from the Christian community because it has no room for the wistful children of unbelief. There is the larger sorrow of seeing the presence of the church slowly fade from the national landscape and become just another sect among many, all marketing themselves as the only true route to eternal salvation. The symbol of this larger sorrow is the sight of old churches that survive only as monuments to loss. Our landscape is dotted with them, mute reminders of a time when the Christian faith was practiced with generous confidence throughout the land. Seeing them closed and shuttered can prompt somber reflection even in those who had little use for them in their glory. This